Chapter 16. Draco and his legal team are almost at the Ministry apparitions point when they're stopped by Weasley. He's alone, technically, though dozens of Ministry officials mill about, rushing off to meetings, or strolling languidly through the large entrance hall. Their whispers echo off the domed ceiling, melding together into a hissing cacophony. A woman with a small child, clearly a visitor, tries to keep her little girl under control. She escapes her mother's grasp with a gleeful cry and scrambles onto the back of an ivory centaur. Draco sticks his tongue out at her when they make eye contact. She returns his gesture as her mother captures her around the waist and pulls her off the statue, placing a kiss on the squirming child's head. Calming, the girl nuzzles into her mother's neck. Draco can't help but smile. It comes with an expected wave of longing, which is no less powerful for being expected. Draco lets his eyes slide away from the pair. Sometimes he thinks the world was created to show him all the things he cannot have. Squaring his shoulders, Draco brushes his hair out of his eyes and turns to face Weasley. "Ronald," he says, with as much courtesy as he can muster. "You're leaving," Weasley says. "Yes," says Draco with a nod. "You told me you'd stay and help, Malfoy." "My counsel advised against it," says Draco. He doesn't want to throw accusations at Weasley. He isn't interested in hearing what he has to say. His team will present him with the truth soon enough, and until then, any interactions with the Aurors should be kept to a minimum. Ronald licks his lips, glances uncertainly at Draco's attorneys. "You shouldn't leave England. You're still under investigation." Draco frowns, scans the room. There is no way that the insecurity Weasley is displaying is real. He wants Draco's guard down. To make him think they are still allied? To ambush him with Aurors waiting in the wings? "I have no wish to interfere with your investigation, Head Aura. I just prefer to be in the comfort of my own home while you conduct it." Weasley's wand hand twitches. Responding before his brain even registers the movement, Draco flexes his fingers, and his wand slips into his hand from his sleeve. Time seems to slow, sound rushes together, offset by the steady pace of Draco's breathing. A hand lands on his shoulder, and he starts taking a step back to face Marius, who is moving to stand between Draco and Ron. "Head Aura Weasley," says Marius, extending a hand. "So good to see you again." Weasley grunts in recognition, giving Marius's hand a firm squeeze. His face goes blank and impassive, making Draco wonder how many of the department's cases Marius has interfered with over the years. "My client has been released on bail. From this point forward, any interaction the DMLE has with him must transpire through myself and my team. I'm sure you understand." Weasley licks his lips, hesitates. Draco thinks he's going to argue, but instead, he nods, stepping back with a flourish. "You always did like to put yourself first," Weasley murmurs, smirking as Draco strides past him. "You're a monster." Draco doesn't respond, doesn't acknowledge him in any way, just walks up to the apparition point. As Draco turns to face the room, Harry enters the hall, stepping right into a beam of sunlight. It plays off of Harry's hair, lights up his eyes. He stops when he notices Draco. They watch each other for what seems like an eternity, and Draco thinks that if he closes his eyes, he'll be able to smell that faint scent of pine. The memory of Harry's touch ghosts across Draco's cheek, and Draco shudders. He tries to remind himself that he barely knows Potter, that they're almost strangers. But the look in Harry's eyes is so familiar, even now, that it fills Draco with warmth, with the sensation of home. Looking away, Draco captures that feeling firmly in his mind and grips his wand and performs the apparition spell. As the world starts to twist around him, he realizes that Harry is sprinting across the hallway towards him. The apparition's spell wraps its tendrils around Draco's body, and Harry jumps onto the small dais, reaching towards Draco's outstretched hand. Draco leans forward, extending his hand and his magic as far as he can, just as they're about to touch. A spell, thick and electric blue, winds itself around Potter's midriff. There's a tug, and Harry is flying backward, right into Weasley's arms. Then Draco's apparition spell clicks closed. With a harsh tug to his solar plexus, Draco is wrenched out of existence and dumped in a heap just outside the manor gates. Draco's on his feet immediately, trying to apparate back into the ministry, but its wards spit him out, turning his magic in on itself and send him straight back to the manor gates. By the time Draco finds the wherewithal to apparate to the visitor's entrance in Scotland Yard, run into the telephone booth, and dial 62442, Harry and Ron are long gone. After that, he spends God knows how long being directed from department to department in an attempt to speak to Potter, until eventually, a secretary leads him into a long, darkened room. For the first time, Draco questions the wisdom of his decision to return for Harry. The ministry was Harry's place of work. There isn't very much that can happen to him here. And anyway, after defeating Voldemort, Draco doubts that there's a place on Earth where much of anything can happen to Potter. The clicking of heels comes from the end of the room, and Draco squints, trying to see the person approaching him. "Hello, Draco," says a familiar female voice. It's Granger. She's older, stricter, far more intimidating, and yet quite beautiful in her sleek, black, unspeakable robes, which shift about her body like a living thing. Maturity and power have clearly done wonders for her, he muses, as he tips his head to her in greeting. "Unspeakable Granger, you look well," he says, and she gives him a tight little smile in return for the compliment. "Where's Potter?" "What do you want with Harry?" she asks. "He was trying to leave with me," says Draco. "Weasley tore him right out of my arms." "Go home, Draco," she says, sounding exasperated. "Harry is quite safe." "Harry's been choosing to stay with me for a reason," Draco replies. "What does she think?" he wonders. "That he's going to back down just because she's an unspeakable? If he felt safe among you, he'd hardly have come to me." He says it as a dig to surprise her, but if she's surprised by the revelation, she doesn't show it. Hermione nods, as though confirming the weather, and Draco can't help but wonder how close the tabs she keeps on Harry are. What kind of authority does her position grant her? Crossing his arms, he waits for her to speak, unsure of what to make of this encounter, afraid of what she knows, afraid of giving away something she doesn't. "Your lawyer just got you out of here on bail," she says. "It's not the best move, returning to the ministry and causing a ruckus." "I hardly see how wanting to speak to Potter is causing a ruckus," says Draco. Hermione laughs. "I doubt there's a person here that doesn't know you're looking for him." "Where is he then?" "He's talking to his best friend," she replies. "Whatever you may think of Ron, surely you don't believe he'd ever put Harry in danger." "I don't know what Weasley is capable of, especially when his safety is threatened." "Ron," says Granger, "has an incredible capacity for love. Everything he does, everything, is in service of that." "Just because you're blind to the evil that he..." Her laugh cuts him off. "Evil? Draco, you served Voldemort because you loved your parents too much to risk them by betraying him. Do you think you are the only man in the world to do horrible things for the ones you love?" "Granger," Draco says, speaking over her, "philosophical musings don't change the fact that Harry and I have become close, and that makes me personally responsible for his, well, do the horrible things you did in the war make you a danger to your loved ones?" she asks, and Draco falls silent. "Malfoy, Ron can hurt anyone in the world, but not his family, not me, and not Harry. Because Ron isn't driven by right and wrong, Ron is driven by love. Much like you are. running around the Ministry of Magic like a headless chicken, putting yourself at risk to save the most powerful man in our generation. She waves an arm, and one of the walls becomes translucent. Behind it is the ministry canteen, with rows upon rows of tables full of officials in their ministry robes, and there, in the center of them, all sit Ron and Harry, talking almost amicably. At first, Draco thinks it's an illusion, but then Potter's features twist in anger, and he slams his palm on the table, making Ron and everyone else in their vicinity jump, turning to them in surprise. Harry waves an arm apologetically and collects himself before picking up his spoon and shoving it forcefully into his broth. Draco sees it then, the folly of his mission, trying to rescue Potter from the clutches of his best friend on the premises of the organization Potter works for, Correction, has worked for the past decade. "You are but a man," she says, "no more or less important than any other member of Wizarding Britain. We here at the Ministry are working very hard to restore our country, to bring everything back to normal. Please let us do our jobs. I'm sure if Harry wishes to, he will contact you. Until then, go home." "You're not going to condemn Weasley's actions?" Draco asks. "Ron's actions are the Ministry's concern, not yours. But you are not referring to your arrest or his current conversation with Harry, are you?" She inspects Draco curiously. "You're referring to the cleanup." When Draco doesn't respond, she sighs. Harry and Ron were hired to protect Britain from any remaining threat left behind by Voldemort and his followers. The people demanded a pound of flesh, and a pound of flesh was given to them. What do you think would have happened otherwise if the Slytherins were just reintegrated back into society as though nothing had happened? "My friends would have been alive," he says. "No," says Hermione, "they wouldn't have been. The people would have torn them apart. When atrocities happen, reparations must be made." "Murder," says Draco, eyes narrowing, "is not reparations. I didn't see any of the Slytherins come forward after the war, offering their fortunes to help us rebuild." "No, they didn't," Draco responds. "So you framed them and took their gold from them, rewriting legislation to make your theft legal." Granger rubs a hand over her face. "Draco, this is the way wars end. To the victors go the spoils. There were probably 100 better ways to handle the end of the war, but we didn't find them. We did what we could. We all do what we can. You too, look, this isn't an accusation, but you aren't trying to find your way back into society. You're living on the outskirts of life. You were one of the most talented wizards in our year, and now you're organizing shipping contracts. We all do what we can, even you." Draco frowns. He wonders if she knows that her husband or his brother are responsible for disseminating the panic that caused the cleanup. He considers telling her, asking her, and decides against it. If she knows, then it doesn't matter. But if she doesn't, if she learns of the red tips found in Weasley's desk now, then she might interfere with Marius's investigation, and that is the last thing he wants. So instead, he gives her what he hopes is an amicable smile. "I need to find Harry," he says. "And what will you do with him?" Hermione asks. Harry may have fallen into a stupor dealing with Ron, but he needs to live. He needs to be alive and real and out in the world, participating in it. What can you offer him? A place beside you, between life's floorboards? What can you give him? What can you give anyone? You withhold life even from yourself. Draco steps back from her. He wants to be offended, hurt. But she's right. He watches her a moment, observes the curls coming out of her tight bun. She really is quite formidable, occupying a position worthy of her mind. She's grown, changed, evolved. It's as if there was this unoccupied space around her as a child, which she has finally grown into, become one with. He's abruptly terribly jealous of her. She is now who she was always meant to be, while Draco is barely more than a shadow of his own potential. And that gap, that space between what is and what could have been, twists through his heart. He had such high hopes for himself, and yet he's achieved nothing. She's right. He is living on the outskirts of life. "Why are you calling me Draco?" he asks. "I've learned a lot about the making of the world since becoming an unspeakable." She replies, "I hold no enmity towards you." "You will not bring Harry to me," Draco says, matter-of-factly. "No," she says, "and you will not call Ronald to arrest me." "No." "Why not?" he asks. "It is not my job to interfere with the course of the world," she replies. "Then what is your job?" Hermione just gives him a soft smile. "It was nice seeing you, Draco." "Thank you for your time, Hermione." Wand gripped tightly in his hand, Draco strides through the manor. He lets his magic seep into its walls, wrap around the stonework, tie in with the old wards. Moving from room to room, he clears away old, crumbling spellwork and replaces it with his own thick, gleaming magic. With a heavy surge of energy, Draco pushes each and every window in the manor open at once. They burst wide, and it feels to Draco like the building is gasping in lungfuls of air, like someone submerged for too long, finally breaking through the surface. With a flick of his wrist, Draco wipes away the glamour covering the scars on his face. He turns to face a tarnished old mirror hanging along the wall. The tarnish on it shrinks in on itself, then clears away entirely, and Draco can see himself, scars and all. He runs his finger over the silver streak, crossing the bridge of his nose. The man staring back at him seems wild, uncontrolled, dangerous, like someone powerful, someone to be reckoned with. For the first time in his life, he doesn't snap his glamour back into place right after removing it. He is a man that served Voldemort, and if people can't stand to look at him for it, so be it. He's done folding himself into pieces for the comfort of society. He's suddenly deeply aware of the fact that he'll never be able to wear glamour again. Something about seeing Granger in her unspeakable robes has shown him what he's missing in a way that nothing before this ever has. It's because everything else was external. Couples and families, children, homes, love. All those things were external wishes and dreams. But Granger revealed to him an internal cavity. He'd thought that Malfoy Enterprises were enough to sustain him, enough space to reach his potential, to utilize his mind, but they weren't. He needs more. He needs to be a man, and not a shadow. Not for Harry, but for himself. He only has as much time as life is willing to give him, and if he uses it to... how had she put it? Hide in the floorboards, then what's the fucking point? As Draco stares at his scared reflection, clouds of dust rise like ghosts around him, and he banishes them through the open windows. He shrugs off his robes, they fall with a pop, gone, only to reappear, hanging neat and clean and pressed in his bedroom wardrobe. Beyond the open windows, the manor grounds burst emerald with life. Rose bushes grow, tangle and blossom before his very eyes. The trees sprout leaves. The lawns become a vivid green, and just before it all starts to overgrow, it stops. Lush and alive and so perfectly manicured, it seems that even an army of gardeners couldn't tend it into such immaculate perfection. Malfoy Manor comes to life around him in a way it hasn't since before Voldemort first set foot in it, and it's exhilarating. Draco stands there, lightheaded and panting in the middle of the grand ballroom as the setting sun paints the horizon an electric red. This is his home, his. And it knows it now. Draco slams the windows closed, the whole building quaking with the force of his spell. Finally, shaking with the exertion, Draco floods his home with warmth, heating each and every room at once. The candles on the chandeliers come to life, filling the room and the corridors beyond it with a soft, golden glow, and Draco looks around himself. Abruptly, he realizes that it is not only his home that feels alive, he feels alive too for the first time since childhood. The thing is, though, is that Granger is wrong. This is not how wars end, with one side obliterating the other. Wars end with reintegration and redemption, because it is the only way a torn society can heal. As long as Draco allows himself to remain a bystander, that is all that he will be. A citizen watching his community crumble. Granger's hands may be tied, as an unspeakable, but his are not. Grabbing hold of all the magic he has inside himself, Draco apparates right from the spot. He feels his ward unfolding for him. He tears his way through the fabric of reality and lands solidly on his feet at the gates of the Malfoy Chateau in France. If there's anyone who knows how to come back from a decimated reputation, it is his father. And Draco has never had any qualms about learning from the best.